Vaikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious, Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vaikatra AI. Welcome to this deep dive. We are tackling, well, a huge and really necessary subwork today, the systematic philosophy of the East. We're digging into Chakravarti Ramprasad's book, Eastern Philosophy, and it's less a history lesson, more like a powerful intellectual corrective.
Oh, it absolutely is. You know, for centuries, Western academia often sort of pushed aside the vast traditions of India and China. Think about Vedanta, Buddhism, Confucianism.
Right, they get labeled mysticism or religion.
Exactly, or maybe just wisdom literature. Ramprasad's whole mission really is to just demolish that distinction.
Yeah.
He argues quite forcefully that these traditions are just as rigorous, just as analytical, sophisticated and systematic as, say, Plato or Kant.
And, you know, if you're a learner out there trying to grasp the really big questions about the self, consciousness, ethics, this matters a lot.
It really does.
I mean, if we ignore basically half the global conversation on this stuff, we miss entirely different ways of finding meaning, developing knowledge, frameworks that feel honestly desperately relevant right now.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Ramprasad is basically building a genuine intellectual bridge here.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of forcing the global philosophical community to see these ancient systems not just as like cultural artifacts.
Yeah, not just museum pieces.
No, but as fundamental ongoing contributions to how we think. Full stop.
Okay, so let's unpack who our guide is on this, because to make a claim that bold, you really need someone who, well, gets both sides of that intellectual divide.
And that's definitely Chakravarti Ramprasad. He's a distinguished professor of comparative religion and philosophy at Lancaster University. Now, what's really crucial about him is this dual mastery he has.
Okay.
So he has deep expertise in classical Indian thought, specifically Sanskrit, which is key, but also rigorous academic training firmly within the Western philosophical tradition.
Ah, okay. That dual mastery feels like the absolute key here, doesn't it? He can actually read the original texts, people like Nagarjuna, the Buddhist philosopher, or Shankara, the Vedantic master.
Mm-hmm. In the original.
And then analyze their arguments using the very tools, you know, logic, epistemology, that Western philosophy uses for someone like Descartes or Hegel.
That's exactly it. He acts as this expert intellectual translator. He just refuses to treat these Eastern thinkers as like exotic curiosities.
Right, not just interesting others.
No, he puts them squarely in the intellectual arena. He makes sure their arguments about causality, consciousness, reality, they keep their original complexity, their intellectual weight, but for us now.
That emphasis on like demonstrable rigor, that's the core thesis. But let me just push back for a second. It sounds great, but isn't it kind of easy to just label any elaborate belief system rigorous? What specifically does Ramprasad point to earn that philosophical label?
That's a fair question. He really focuses on two main things. First, the actual development of formal logic and epistemology, especially in schools like Nyaya in India. And second, just the sheer systematic nature of the metaphysical arguments themselves.
Okay.
He shows how these systems developed really comprehensive answers to those universal problems. You know, what is knowledge? What's the structure of reality? How do mind and matter relate? Stuff like that.
Okay, here's where I think it gets really interesting, though. Ramprasad details how these systems cover a lot of the same ground as Western philosophy, but often with this crucial difference, the central focus on something called soteriology.
Yes, that's absolutely vital. Soteriology. It basically means that philosophical understanding isn't just, you know, abstract knowledge for its own sake.
Like knowing facts.
Right. It's intrinsically linked to practical, transformative, lived wisdom. So the theoretical knowledge, say, the really detailed metaphysics of Brahman and Hinduism, isn't just theory. It's understood as a direct pathway to actually achieving liberation or harmony, whether you call that mokka or finding the Tao.
It's this integration, isn't it? Integrating your intellectual life with your ethical actions in a way that, well, we just don't see prioritized as much in modern Western philosophy.
Exactly.
So the book's core purpose, then, is really to demonstrate the maturity, the complexity of these arguments, and insist they belong in the biggest global philosophical conversation. Okay, let's dive into that conversation, starting where Ramprasad begins. The philosophical bedrock of India.
Right, we start with the Upanishads. These are really the foundational philosophical texts within the Vedas, and they introduce two absolutely enormous concepts. First, Brahman.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate unchanging cosmic reality.
The big one.
The big one. And second, Atman. which is the individual self, or maybe soul is a close enough word.
And the truly staggering philosophical realization, the equation that emerges, is Atman equals Brahman. The idea that your individual self at its very deepest level is actually identical to the absolute reality.
It's famously summed up in that phrase, tatvamasi, that thou art, you are that. And realizing that non-separation isn't just about, you know, intellectually agreeing with it.
It's not a belief.
No, it's about a deep internal experiential knowledge that fundamentally shatters the illusion of being separate. And that realization leads to mukha, liberation. Freedom from the cycle of suffering and rebirth, what they call samsara.
Okay, so once that huge foundation is laid, Ram Prasad then takes us into the different systematic schools of the darshanas. And you see this fascinating internal debate happening within Hinduism itself. Like, look at the contrast between the radical dualism of Sakya and the radical non-dualism of Vedanta.
Sakya is such a fascinating counterpoint. It argues for two completely distinct eternal realities. There's Puru, that's pure consciousness, the observer, the subject. And then there's Pratiti, that's matter, nature, the object, everything that changes.
Okay, so two separate things.
Totally separate. And for Sakya, suffering basically comes from mistakenly identifying your pure consciousness, Puru, with the activities of matter, Pratiti. It's an argument for ultimate separation as the path to clarity.
And then, bam, you get Shankara's Advaita Vedanta, which is just the total philosophical opposite, isn't it? It's the ultimate non-dualism.
Absolutely. Advaita Vedanta argues that Brahman, that ultimate reality, is the only reality, period. Everything else, the world we see, touch, experience, our sense of being a separate self, it's all ultimately a relative appearance.
Yeah.
The term used is maya. It's not quite illusion in the sense of not there, more like a misperception of the true reality.
But wait, okay. If you're arguing that the world we experience every day is ultimately, let's say, illusory or maya, how can that be considered rigorous philosophy? Doesn't real rigor mean engaging with, you know, observable reality and having solid principles for what counts as true?
That is the million-dollar question. And Ram Prasad's point is crucial here. The Indian tradition absolutely did not ignore this. The development of that philosophical rigor came precisely from schools like Nyaya. Nyaya specialized almost entirely in epistemology, the theory of knowledge and logic. They developed these incredibly detailed, sophisticated systems for figuring out what counts as a valid source of knowledge. Things like perception, inference, analogy, testimony.
So they were building the tools.
Exactly. Building the logical tools needed to defend their positions, particularly against schools that argued the world was fundamentally real in the way we perceive it. The sheer logical intensity, the focus on valid reasoning, it's just undeniable. It completely blows away the stereotype of it all being purely mystical.
Right. Okay, so from that intense internal debate within Hinduism, we then transition to the Buddhist revolution, which, as you said, arrives partly as a direct philosophical critique, especially of that Vedantic idea of a permanent self, the Atman.
Mm-hmm.
The core challenge is maybe best summarized in the Four Noble Truths, right? The diagnosis of suffering, its cause, its cessation, and the path.
Yes, and the most radical doctrine, the one that really distinguishes Buddhism from its Hindu roots, is Anatman, the doctrine of no self.
No self. So directly challenging Atman.
Directly. The Buddha argued there is no permanent, unchanging, independent soul or self, no agat to be found. What we call the self is just a temporary, constantly fluctuating bundle or aggregate of five components. They're called the skandhas, like form, sensation, perception, mental formations, consciousness, always changing.
Okay, but if the self is an illusion, or at least just this temporary collection, how do you even talk about things like cause and effect or continuity from one moment to the next, or even rebirth, which Buddhism also talks about?
Yeah, yes. Good question. That's where this incredibly complex but foundational metaphysical doctrine comes in. It's called Pratityasamutpada, usually translated as dependent origination or interdependent arising.
Dependent origination, okay.
It's definitely not easy to grasp quickly. But Ram Prasad makes it clear. The core idea is nothing exists independently. Everything arises, exists, and ceases in dependence on other conditions and phenomena.
So it's all connected.
Deeply interconnected. Imagine reality less like a collection of separate billiard balls bouncing off each other and more like a vast shimmering net or tapestry. If you pull on one single thread, the whole pattern shifts and adjusts.
Okay, I can sort of picture that.
So this radical interconnectedness allows for causality, for continuity of process, even for rebirth as a stream of consciousness without needing a permanent unchanging soul to migrate from one life to the next. It's really quite ingenious.
Okay, so that's India. Now, shifting gears across Asia, we move to China. And Ramprasad points out the focus kind of shifts here, doesn't it? Less about, say, liberation from samsara, and more about achieving harmony, social, political, cosmic, right here, right now.
That's a good way to put it. And we start with Confucianism.
Which Ramprasad presents not just as, you know, wise old sayings, but as a truly systematic, ethical, and political theory. It's all centered on self-cultivation.
Absolutely. The key virtues are concepts like Ren, that's often translated as humaneness, benevolence, deep empathy. It's considered the supreme virtue. And Elgren, or ritual propriety.
Ritual propriety? What does that actually mean?
It's about the proper conduct, the specific social forms, the etiquette, the ceremonies that actually maintain social harmony and order. It's about knowing your role and performing it correctly and sincerely.
Okay, so Ren is the inner virtue, Elkham is the outer expression.
Kind of, yes. Yeah. And the ultimate ethical goal is to become a Junzi, the exemplary person, the noble person, sometimes translated as gentleman, but it's more than that. It's someone achieved through relentless, lifelong moral refinement and learning.
And this isn't just personal ethics, right? It's deeply political, too.
Oh, completely. For Confucius, true leadership, legitimate rule, comes from profound moral character, from being a Junzglin. It's not just about having power or technical skill. It's about moral authority. A ruler leads by example.
Which is a pretty radical political idea even today. Now, the sort of philosophical counterpoint, or maybe complement, to that structured social ethical approach is Taoism, and this elusive concept of the Tao, the way.
Yes, the Tao. It's presented as the ineffable, spontaneous, underlying, fundamental order and flow of the universe. It's mysterious. It's subtle.
Hence that famous opening line of the Tao Te Ching, right? The Tao that can be spoken is not the eternal Tao.
Exactly. It's an immediate warning against relying too heavily on language, on fixed concepts, on rigid structures to grasp ultimate reality. It's almost the ultimate critique of over-rationalization.
And the central ethical principle that flows from trying to align with this cosmic harmony, this Tao, is Wu Wei, often translated as non-action, but that sounds passive.
It does sound passive, and Ramprasad is very careful to clarify this. Wu Wei does not mean literally doing nothing or being lazy or passive.
Okay.
It means action that aligns perfectly, spontaneously with the natural patterns and processes of existence. It's action without excessive striving, without forcing outcomes against the grain, without unnecessary interference.
So like water flowing around a rock instead of trying to smash through it?
That's a classic Taoist image, yes. Think of a master craftsman whose movements seem effortless, or a skilled sailor using the wind instead of fighting it. It's a highly sophisticated understanding of effective, potent, yet spontaneous agency, acting with the Tao, not against it.
Okay. So we've journeyed through these massive, complex systems in India and China. After covering all this ground, what are the big unifying lessons? What does Ramprasad really insist we take away from this deep dive?
I think the most essential one, the one that cuts across almost all these traditions, is the fundamental integration of theory and practice. Philosophy isn't meant to just sit on a shelf as an abstract exercise.
It has to do something.
It must be a way of life. The knowledge you gain, the understanding you develop, it has to fundamentally transform your ethical behavior, your existential state, how you actually live in the world.
Which really does provide a necessary, maybe uncomfortable reflection point for us today, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why do we so often compartmentalize? We study ethics in university, but does it change how executives run companies? This integration really challenges that modern separation.
It absolutely does. A second really powerful theme Ramprasad highlights is a shared skepticism about the absolute limits of language and reason when it comes to grasping ultimate truth.
We saw that already, right?
We did. With Upanishads describing Brahman as neti, neti, not this, not that, you can only say what it isn't. And again, in Taoism, with the warning about naming the Tao, It suggests that while reason and language are necessary tools, they have boundaries. They can't capture everything.
Especially the ultimate and the final key message, the driving force behind the whole book, really, is the urgent need for genuine global dialogue.
Yes. Ramprasad argues, very convincingly, I think, that these Eastern systems offer alternative epistemologies, different ways of knowing. ways based perhaps more on contemplative insight, direct experience, experiential realization.
Rather than purely on logic or empirical observation alone.
Right. And these alternative approaches don't replace Western methods, but they seriously challenge the idea that rationalistic approaches are the only valid way to knowledge. They vastly enrich the global philosophical toolkit, the global conversation.
Okay, let's pull out a few key ideas, almost like quotes, that really capture the essence of Ramprasad's argument.
Sure. I think one that really nails his methodological point is something like this. The philosophical traditions of Asia developed systematic approaches to fundamental questions that deserve serious intellectual engagement rather than exotic fascination.
That cuts right to the chase. No more treating it as just interesting or other. And emphasizing that practical goal we talked about. The goal of Eastern philosophy is not merely theoretical understanding, but transformative wisdom that integrates knowledge with lived understanding.
Mm-hmm. And maybe one more, just to clarify that tricky Taoist concept. Wu Wei does not mean passivity, but rather action that aligns with the natural patterns and processes of existence, representing sophisticated understanding of effective agency.
That's really helpful, showing it's about skilled action, not inaction. Okay, that's a powerful set of tools and perspectives. But how can someone listening, maybe someone busy, running a team, just trying to stay sane in a pretty hectic world, how can they actually apply this knowledge, like right now?
Well, let's take the professional world. Think about management and that concept of Wu Wei. Instead of constantly micromanaging, imposing rigid top-down plans, maybe trying to force things.
Striving against the natural flow of the team.
Exactly. You could try managing by empowering your team, trusting their abilities, working with their existing strengths and the natural process of the project. That Taoist approach could actually be a blueprint for more effective, less stressful, maybe more decentralized management.
That makes sense. And thinking about ethical leadership, that Confucian ideal of the Jinsling, it offers a real countermodel to maybe a purely profit-driven approach. Imagine a leader who genuinely prioritizes moral integrity, long-term character development, ran maybe over just hitting the next quarterly target.
It would fundamentally shift how a company operates, wouldn't it? Its values, its long-term vision.
Definitely. And what about on a more personal level? Dealing with stress, anxiety?
There, the Buddhist analysis of suffering is incredibly practical. The idea that suffering largely springs from craving, from attachment to things being a certain way. That gives you a systematic diagnostic tool.
A way to understand why you're feeling anxious or discontented.
Precisely. It helps you identify the specific attachments causing the friction. It offers a framework for mental well-being that goes, I think, quite a bit deeper than just, say, practicing mindfulness without understanding the underlying causes of unease.
For me, thinking about the final takeaways, what I really loved most about digging into this work is how meticulously Ramprasad dismantles that old, frankly, ethnocentric assumption that real philosophy is exclusively a Western thing that started in ancient Greece and stayed there.
It's such an important correction.
It really is. The book feels like a genuine open invitation to a much wider, much more inclusive global conversation about the biggest questions we all face as humans.
Absolutely. And what surprised me most, perhaps speaking purely from an intellectual history perspective, was just the sheer level of formal, abstract, logical rigor developed within some of the Indian schools, especially Naya.
You mentioned their focus on epistemology.
Yes, but it's more than that. They developed these incredibly precise logical systems, debating inference, validity, fallacies, systems that are every bit as complex and sophisticated as anything in Western formal logic. It just completely defies that lingering, lazy stereotype that all Eastern thought is purely intuitive or mystical. The analytical power is undeniable.
It's a truly beautiful synthesis showing the richness and diversity of global thought, isn't it? A necessary expansion of our philosophical horizons.
I love that.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.